So that brings us to our first science talk this morning, and in our symposium on integrated science for society and the environment. And Scott Collins from the University of New Mexico will present the lead presentation and set the tone and context for this morning's symposium. Thank you, Scott. This is the first time I've had to perform in front of my major professor in over 25 years, and I'm terrified about that. Anyway, forgive me. My job is to actually provide a little bit of a context for some of the presentations that you're going to hear today. And at the same time, I want to emphasize that the presentations you're going to hear today really form sort of the background and the foundation for what we're proposing to do as a network. So I want to introduce how we got to where we are today and our goals of building on the existing success or past success of activities both in the LTR network and beyond. So we have been through a planning process over the last 2 years based on recommendations from the LTR 20-year review that suggested that the network was not really functioning at the network level, that it was essentially underutilized and not achieving its true potential, and that we should really think about the ability of developing network scale science. And so we have embarked on a 2-year planning process that has involved a large number of people and lots of workshops from which we've developed an integrated conceptual framework that I'll briefly highlight today, and a number of other products. And I want to sort of set the context then for what we're going to do and sort of provide some information about where we think the network is going with this project. So it's embedded within an initiative which is called Integrated Science and Society in the Environment, which we feel is something that is of interest generated by the broader research community, and from which we believe we have some kind of mechanistic approach to actually achieve some of these goals. So again, going back to the planning process, we submitted a proposal to NSF to do this planning process and bring people together, both inside and outside the LTR network. The goals were really to develop a new LTR science agenda. That's a stated goal in the proposal. And you really think about research activities that will lead to multi-site, really collaborative, integrated research, sort of things that are going on at the network scale. There were other objectives, including thinking about how we are managed as a network, governance structure, what our education outreach activities are, our server infrastructure needs, and how those tie in with other networks. Right? So we have a number of goals in the planning process. So the products that will come out of the planning process are many. We have an education outreach strategic plan. We have a new governance structure. Jim mentioned trends, which I'll talk about in a little minute, just a second here, and you'll hear more about it when you get to speak. We have a very comprehensive cyber infrastructure strategic plan. We have an initiative called Integrated Science for Society and the Environment that's much broader than the LTR network. And then we have a goal of actually developing our own transdisciplinary, multi-site, long-term research program, which would be, I think, one of a kind in the world. All right, so what are we talking about here, some of these products? Well, the TRENDS effort is a really wonderful collaboration between the LTR network, the USDA Agricultural Research Service, USDA Forest Service, and of course NSF helping along here, to bring together a compilation of long-term ecological data sets and to put them together in a volume that is somewhat synthetic and provides derived data. And although the book itself will be a static document that will highlight some of the activities that have taken place in these various long-term research programs, there will be an associated website with updated data streams on there. And one of the efforts is to demonstrate what we've seen as trends over the long term, but also to emphasize the need for synthesis and to provide data sets that can be used in both education and research activities. So the TRENDS project is one of the things associated with the planning grant. It's more of the, in a sense, the retrospective part. You know, where are we, where have we been, and where are we now? As I said, we have a very detailed cyber infrastructure plan. This plan is both LTR-centric, because there are specific needs for any given network, but it's also broadly visionary with regard to how the LTR network and its cyber infrastructure needs tie into other existing networks and emerging networks. Very quickly, a little about integrated science for society and the environment. So this is what we think of as a conceptual area of research that the research community, the broader research community, is particularly interested in and is interested in generating. We are interested in seeing resources become available for multiple approaches to what we're thinking of as socio-ecological research. We didn't invent the term, right? But it is emerging really as an area of concentration in, I think, the research community that includes the ecological sciences, the geosciences, and the social sciences. I believe they're all coming together under this framework, which we can think of as a socio-ecological framework. And there are major components. The climate change is a key driver in the system, social-ecological systems, and then ecological systems. The LTR network has particular strengths in things like biotic structure, altered biothermal cycles. There are other things you can put in here, but it sort of gives you the nested hierarchical approach to how these systems might fit together and the beginning of a framework and setting the context for interactions. All right. So what are some of the ecological drivers in here? I have to show some data, you know, because this comes to happen, right? So these are not our data. These are just famous data. Okay, so here's global temperatures. Kind of going along about here, and then we can see this pretty dramatic rise in global temperature starting around 1940. I tried to line up the axis here. And if we look over here in this figure, there are four lines in this figure, including reactive nitrogen availability globally, atmospheric CO2 globally, human population growth, and energy consumption as a representative example of human use of natural resources. Okay. So if you look at all of these things, there was a paper by Michael Mann et al. Published in Nature that created the hockey stick diagram. It's very controversial. It's got a lot of attention in press, in which they talked about this rapid temperature increase. And we are arguing in the LTR network that if you add this hockey stick with these four hockey sticks, you have a hockey team of environmental stresses that are taking place right now and that are affecting the Earth globally. These are both human-driven. They're all human-driven. Some are direct sort of social, economic variables. Some are ecological variables. So if you look at when ecological theory was developed in the early part of the last century when rates of change were relatively constant. They're slow. And now look at these rates of change. It's time to really rethink theoretical foundations for our discipline based on these drivers, which we think of as press drivers. They're just constantly pushing on the system. Right. So what is some of the, how does this relate to sort of human population dynamics? Well, this slide from presentations from the CAP LTR, Urban LTR in Arizona, talking about urban population growth and proportion of, or growth of cities and megacities. All right, so we can see that predictions show that 60% of the global population will be urban by 2050, and that also by 2015, not very far from now, there will be 60 megacities on the planet. Okay, right now there are 19. So the urban growth is phenomenal. All right. And so that means that there's a point location for these human impacts that they're not uniformly distributed across the planet. Right. So we have that kind of spatial variability in some of these impacts. Out there. Now this is totally cool stuff that is completely incomprehensible to you guys. I just got to tell you this stuff anyway. All right. So there was a great paper published by a guy named Michael Batty in Nature in December of 06. And it was just called Rank Clocks. And what he is doing is he's looking at the global statistical signature of urban growth from the time in which there were urban environments. Right? And so this rank clock is a graphical depiction of the importance of individual cities relative to other cities on the planet. And the colors go from the orange is early in time, and the blue would be the cities that come in later in time. All right, so you read them around this way, and the trajectories move in that direction. Each axis, in this case, is a decade, so it's a census scale, and the axis is most important city to least important city out there along that axis. And so you can plot an individual city and see how its rank is changing over time. All right, whoops. So if we look here, this is ranks for Phoenix. So Phoenix doesn't even fall into the top 50 until 1950, and now it has gone within 20 years into one of the biggest cities in the United States. This is about 266 cities, all right? That's growth, all right? Here we see, I think I put Albuquerque in here somewhere. That red one's probably Albuquerque. Las Vegas right there. So there are differential growth rates
among urban environments, and some are growing so rapidly, it's incredible. Whereas if we look on this one, these are the cities that are spiraling out of importance relative to rank. And there are things like Norfolk and Richmond, Newark, Buffalo. So we see that very dramatic shift in the importance of cities, relatively speaking, on the planet, and differential growth rates. Now, the really cool stuff about this is that we are now applying this methodology to rank abundance curves and changes in species communities in nitrogen fertilization experiments, and using these statistics and collaborating with this guy right here, who's at the University College of London. We've never met him. He's modifying his software for us to use in a new context. So that's how collaborations can just bubble up out of this stuff. All right. So we have population effects very spatially. Here's a paper from Brown et al., Dan Brown et al. In ecological applications in 05, in which they had a special feature on exurbanization. And again, it shows this is the change in density of population from 1950 to 2000 on a county basis. And again, it's not uniformly distributed, right? There are areas where there's high growth, there are areas where there's low growth. I mean, we know that, but that means that a network scale analysis is needed to deal with these kinds of variable rates of change and variable impacts. And this is exurbanization. In 1950, 5% of the land mass of the U.S. would be considered exurban. By 2000, 25% of the land mass is now exurban. So we're seeing changes, and much of that exurbanization is associated with those urban environments that I was just showing you in those earlier slides. So now, how are we going to take an ecological approach or a research approach to these very challenging issues that involve population growth, consumption, and resources that affect our natural environments? All right. Well, there have been a number of frameworks that have been proposed to sort of link social and ecological sciences and geosciences. So this is one from Stuart Pickett in a paper that was in Annual Review of Ecology and Systematics, at least looking at the key components of a framework and in a hierarchical level within each of these components. So there's one way to sort of break down your thinking is into sort of what are the components and, you know, how do they hierarchically fit together. And then there are other frameworks that have been developed. This is a paper that I think has come out now in Ecology and Society, the online journal. And this is another competitive, this is a framework that I call competitive. Right? It's the us versus them framework where everybody meets in the battlefield in the middle. So there's pop production and, you know, extraction and bad things, there's nature and good things, and they all collide here. And it may not be the best approach to generating, you know, a positive feedback between social ecological systems. All right, here are a couple of other models that are linear. These are linear with, so we start off with, data and understanding, and we go and we just feed that into environmental policy and they listen to us. And then there's one with very little interaction. So we have ecology, socioeconomics, then knowledge of ecosystems, and then management. But both of these things, really, they lack feedbacks, right? There's key components of these models that are simply missing in these linear models that lack feedbacks. So what we have come up with, which it took a lot of time and a lot of interaction among a lot of scientists, is this particular framework. This is our conceptual framework, all right? In that it has the biological and geophysical template over here, so ecology and geosciences. We can think about various things, and you can label these in different ways. These are some of my favorites. You can substitute them in. All right, so we have community structure, ecosystem function. They feed back into ecosystem services. This is a key linkage, then, into the social, cultural, economic template, which includes human outcomes and human behavior. And it's human behavior that feeds back into the presses and pulses in the environment that feed back into our geophysical template again. So this nice iterative model has feedbacks throughout. And the linkages are based on research questions, very generalizable research questions. Right? So we've listed the questions here. As I said, they're quite general. So how do changes in vital ecosystem services feed back to alter human behavior? Okay, now it's the nice thing about this framework, or what we feel is an important component of the framework, is that it's quite generalizable and that it can be used in specific contexts. And those are some of the contexts you're going to hear today. So this is taking that framework with the components, sorry, and the questions, and applying them to more forested ecosystems. All right. So what we've done here, as far as our process, is that we've come up with a framework that we think we can use to link the research programs and develop a new research overlay for the LTR network. And that overlay has a iterative, long-term component to it. It's multi-site and it's truly interdisciplinary. We're going to hear some talks today that would demonstrate that how some of these components could play out, and they provide the foundation for where we want to go in the future.
I didn't hear you mention the new emerging neon network. How does that get through to the last model? It was an interesting way to think about it.
Neon is a very important program and has tremendous potential. To some extent, the answer to that lies in how neon is ultimately designed and what the actual layout is of neon. At the same time, I really want to emphasize that the LTR network has been in existence since 1980. The National Science Foundation has probably invested well over $300 million into the LTR network over that time, probably more if you put it in today's dollars. The annual budget is fairly substantial, perhaps closer to the range of so in a sense, I guess in a very biased perspective, I might ask, you know, whether or not we ask a different question, and that question might be, what is NEON going to do to take advantage of this incredible research infrastructure that already exists, the long research history that has taken place at a lot of LTR sites, and the record of sort of collaboration that exists within the LTR network. And I'm willing to bet that there are individuals from other agencies here that could ask the same question, you know, Agricultural Research Service, watersheds, and things like that. I think NEON has an incredible opportunity to lay out an infrastructure that would bring those things together into a truly national scale research platform. And I hope that happens. Thank you.